When I was in seminary, they actually told us you should always read longer, not shorter passages of Scripture so that there would be more context for the passage. In a couple of months, speaking of seminary, in a couple of months, I'm going to celebrate the 24th anniversary of my graduation from Princeton Theological Seminary. So I guess it's fair to say that it's been a little while since I was a student, but even so, I remember the last moment of my formal education, when I handed in my final exam. Fittingly enough, the class was on the spirituality of death and dying, and the professor was an adjunct who mostly worked at a hospice in Philadelphia. And when I finished my last final exam on that beautiful spring day in New Jersey, I got this feeling of euphoria. And I walked the paper up to the professor, and I handed it to her, and I said something like, "This is the last exam of my seminary education, and I don't think I'll go on to get a higher degree," which means this exam marks the end of a formal process that began in Judy Stavely's kindergarten class at the Mendocino Grammar School and has continued year after year, uninterrupted, through grammar school and middle school and high school and college. And now, after all this time, I'm done. I'm about to embark on a new adventure. And she looked up at me, and I could tell from the weariness in her eyes that she just didn't give a damn. It is a fact that two people can consider the same object and see two entirely different things. What she saw was another test to grade, one that no doubt exposed the futility of trying to impart great ideas to students who are mostly asleep. Whereas I saw the final strophes in the epic poem that was my education. I saw a diving board hanging over the deep end of my future. I saw any number of mixed metaphors, and believe it or not, I was walking on air. There was a lot I liked about being a seminary student, but one of the reasons I was so excited to hand in that test and to put Princeton Theological Seminary in the rear view mirror of my Isuzu Trooper as I drove west back to California, one of the things that made me happy to leave was the experience I had trying to learn biblical Greek. I'm dyslexic, which means using the alphabet I learned in Judy Stavely's kindergarten class, that's hard enough for me. In fact, my sermons are printed on a font that's meant to help people with dyslexia. So, our regular English language is hard enough. Negotiating the difference between a theta and a phi, that's killer for me. Besides, my professor, my Greek professor, was going through a crisis of faith and a divorce at the same time. And in the middle of the semester, he had a massive cancerous growth removed from the right side of his nose, which meant that his depressed and angst-ridden lectures were delivered through the fog of painkillers and from behind a bandage that covered most of his face. So Greek, biblical Greek, is not my strong suit. But Greek is something that I had to use the first time I read this morning's lesson from John in the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, which is the version we use here at Montclair Presbyterian Church. This is the story of Nicodemus, a Pharisee visiting Jesus by night. And every English language version of the Bible I've read, save for the New Revised Standard Version, has Jesus saying to Nicodemus, "You must be born again." As a result, English-speaking Christians have for centuries now spoken of the importance of spiritual rebirth. We talk about being born again. In fact, that is a term sometimes used with pride and sometimes with derision, depending upon your point of view, to describe a whole class of American Protestants who value and promote the experience of religious conversion. Born-again Christians, we call them. But then not long after I turned in that last final exam and dove into the waters of pastoral ministry, I read this morning's lesson in the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. And in this version, Jesus does not say you must be born again. Instead, Jesus says you must be born from above. Well, this discovery sent me scrambling to my various Greek resources and trying to remember every shred of Greek I got in seminary. And in the process, I discovered that the Greek word, anothein, which is used in this passage, can either mean from above or anew. So when Jesus says to Nicodemus, you must be born, and he uses that Greek word, anothein, what he's doing is he's kind of playing a trick on his guest. He's saying that a person must be born from above, but his guest, who has an earthly mindset, can only hear, you must be born again. Which, of course, is absurd, because you can't climb back in your mother's womb. So Jesus throws him a bone. He says, but it's equally confusing, because he says, you know, the Spirit blows where it blows, and you don't see the Spirit, but you hear the Spirit, you see what it does. But so then Jesus is using the word for spirit in Greek, which is pneuma, which also means wind. So the bone only serves to confuse Nicodemus further, because he can't hear Jesus talking about the Spirit. He only hears Jesus talking about the wind. So just like how my final exam, that great momentous end to my education, was just another exam and more work for my professor, so it is when Jesus says you must be born from above, and the Spirit blows where it will, Nicodemus hears, you must be born again. And the wind blows where it will. And English translations of the Bible, going back at least as far as the latter half of the 14th century, have translated this passage as Nicodemus heard it, not as the author of John intended it. Now, I'm of the opinion that the challenge of this word anothein, to be born anew or from above, this is a challenge that human beings face all of the time. And historically, humans have failed the test again and again. For example, when Europeans first came to what we now call North and South America, they didn't have a spiritual mindset, right? They didn't say, wow, here's an interesting place we didn't know about, filled with a lot of people we had no idea existed. Let's get to know this place and these people. Let's learn their languages. Maybe we can figure out ways to establish mutually beneficial trade relationships and cultural exchanges. That's not what they said. They said, I'll take that and I'll kill them. Right? And here we are centuries later speaking in European language in a place that rightfully belongs to the Ohlone people. Europeans weren't looking at the Americas with a spiritual perspective. They were listening to the wind when they should have been listening to the Spirit. A few hundred years later, after Europeans started traveling across the Atlantic in large numbers, Charles Darwin came up with a way to articulate and to explain the evolution of species. And some people saw in Darwin's work an amazing presentation of something remarkably beautiful. Life evolves and changes and becomes complex. That's listening to the Spirit. Other people listened to the wind and used Darwin's theories to excuse the practice of eugenics, which is the practice of sterilizing or even killing those people whose genes were deemed undesirable, those who lacked intelligence or who were mentally ill or who were criminals or who were considered racially inferior and ethnically impure. That's listening to the wind. More recently, in a place where I grew up, there were these amazing redwood trees, right? And logging companies used to look at the forests, and what they saw was a renewable resource that, if managed properly, could provide jobs and economic vitality for as long as people needed lumber. Then the companies were bought out by large corporations that listened to the wind. And what they did is they looked at the forest and saw quick profit. And the industry, with its jobs and its economic benefits, now has largely disappeared from the North Coast, along with the health of the forests. Or consider the words Black Lives Matter. Some people read those words, and in their minds they see the word also at the end, as in Black Lives Matter also, and it becomes a thing of empowerment and revolution. Other people read those words and add the word only at the beginning, and they get offended. I think it's a test of our frame of mind. Are we born from above, or are we chasing the wind? The same can be said for the simple and seemingly benign phrase, make America great again. I mean, who's against that, right? Except that for those not born from above, those who are filled not by the Spirit but by wind, making America great seems to involve returning to the America that existed before the civil rights movement and before the advancement of women's rights and before marriage equality, before the musical Hamilton. And America, where corporations can do things like destroy the redwood forest and call it patriotism. An America not dedicated to the proposition that all people are created equal or that black lives matter also. Other people, those born of the Spirit, might consider the greatness of a country to be tied to its ability to make sure no child goes to bed hungry or no innocent person is sent to prison. Those born from above might think a country great if it welcomes immigrants and doesn't feel a need to wage war every few years. A country with restored greatness might provide quality health care for everyone, even if it means not building a new aircraft carrier. A great country might educate its citizens with an educational system that pays teachers what they are worth. A great nation might continue to invest in the arts. A great nation might want to lead the world in efforts to preserve creation. There are so many ways a nation's greatness could be restored if only our leaders were born from above and filled with the Spirit. Let's pray for them. Dearly beloved, we must heed the words of Jesus who told Nicodemus that no one can see the kingdom of heaven without being born from above. As surely as we are born of water, after roughly 40 weeks of nurture in the waters of the womb, so we also must be nurtured in God's womb, in the Spirit, and then we must be born from above. We must be children of the Spirit, faithful folk whose eyes see the world through the lens of Spirit, whose actions are directed by an inner spiritual compass. Having a life of the Spirit, born from above and filled with the Spirit, let us see every human as a child of God, regardless of what borders they may or may not have crossed, or which languages they may speak. Let us understand that every religion is a path upon which humans walk while searching for the same God we seek on whatever path we tread. Let us consider the earth as a gift from God, subject to stewardship and not exploitation. Let us consider our economy as something meant to bring benefits to everyone. And let us hope to live in a world in which evidence of the Spirit's life is made manifest in the good work of humans who are born from above.